Welcome to His Holy Church on X Spaces, where we're going to address a variety of topics concerning the scriptures, both Old Testament and New Testament, where you can listen or participate in the conversation. Make sure you follow us at His Holy Church on X to be notified of topics. Thank you. Welcome. So anyway, we have one more X broadcast, which hopefully we'll do every Sunday night at 5. We'll see if other people join in. The topic today is the bait and the bondage. You know, I just pulled these out of a hat and made a list, and it's related to topics that we talk about on a regular basis. And it's also a topic that is terribly misunderstood. Basically, most people do not believe that they're in bondage. And of course, we can quote Goethe, who said, "No one is more hopelessly enslaved than those who believe they are free." And of course, if you grow up in a particular frame of mind with people all around you thinking in a particular way, you're going to think that your standards for observing the world are going to come from all the other people that you're around. You're not necessarily, almost nobody begins as an independent thinker. And of course, what does that even mean to be an independent thinker? Can we think independently of everybody else in life? So what is life really all about? It's either about being free or being bond. It's about being righteous or unrighteous. It's about knowing good and knowing evil. And knowing them in the sense of knowing the distinction between the two. Evil knows what it means to be evil. And good probably knows what it means to be good. And either you're moving towards the one or you're moving towards the other. Yeah, all roads lead to the kingdom of God, and all roads lead to the destruction. It's just about which direction you're going. And so anyway, I put together a number of questions that we can look at, and hopefully more people will join us. I already have a page on bondage and the yoke of bondage and the bondage of Egypt. These are all major themes in the Bible. Even if you go all the way to Revelation, there's a quote in the Bible, Revelation, where the merchants of the earth will have a full stock of slaves and souls of men. Now, what would be the difference between a slave and a soul of men? Well, a slave is someone who has to obey. He's obligated to obey. He's in bondage, so to speak. But and it's a legitimate bondage, probably by consent or the consent of his parents who sold him into bondage. That was, you know, very common that people, you know, Benjamin Franklin was in bondage when he was a young man as a apprentice to his brother. And that meant he was under a contract to finish work as an apprentice to his brother to learn the printing trade. And he broke that bond. He walked away from it. Of course, now his brother could have penalized him, and as far as I know, he never tried to, but he was very disappointed that Benjamin Franklin did not finish his indenture as this individual who was learning the trade of printing. He learned it fast enough, so he ended up going into printing himself. But part of the deal is that someone is going to provide you with a service, an education. He's going to get an education on how to be a printer. And that's going to cost his brother something in time and energy and effort to provide him that education. But he is obligated to work so many years in this apprenticeship to not only learn the trade, but to pay back his brother for having taken the time to teach him That's why you have an apprenticeship contract. Otherwise, the guy would just come and learn what he needed to and take off, and you would be out. I mean, there's actually, if you went and started a business, I worked for a company, Shakey's Pizza Parlors, years ago, and they had a rule there in the franchise that you could not pirate employees from other Shakey's franchises. Which, now, why would somebody do that? Well, somebody hires somebody, they train them as cook, they train them as running the cash register, they maybe even train them to be an assistant manager and keep the books, and how to do all the processes, and then somebody else comes and offers them a job at a few cents more, and he goes to work for the other guy, but the first guy is the one who trained him. He never gets back his investment in that individual. So that's against the rules in a franchise. They put it in there. So what would we see that correlated today? Well, you can go get a student loan. And that student loan will allow you to go to college. And you're supposed to pay that student loan back. But a lot of people don't want to pay it back. They want somebody else to pay it back. Or they want it just forgiven them. Now, I assume that Benjamin Franklin's brother forgave him eventually. I haven't read any particular letters from Benjamin discussing the matter, except for the fact that he did not finish his apprenticeship. But to be honorable in society, if you agree, you know, I'll get this free education, but I'll work for you for 7 years, the first 3 years, maybe you're not very good at all the different aspects of printing. But in the last 3 years, you probably will be. And that guy will have a proficient worker working for him, somebody he's trained up, and he'll be paid back. And maybe before you finish your apprenticeship and he knows you're going to go out on your own, he'll hire somebody else as an apprentice and he'll use him and teach him. And he will be advantaged by the extra knowledge that he gets. Still today, electricians, I know several electricians that went and apprenticed, became a journeyman, and eventually became licensed electricians. And now they're out doing business on their own and competing against the electrician who taught them. And that's just part of business. But there's other indentures that may go beyond 7 years. And of course, if you take out a student loan, you owe it forever. It will follow you forever. And there are other indentures. Now, we've just been finishing a study on Jacob. Jacob made a deal with Laban where I will work for you for 7 years. At the end of that 7 years, you'll give me Rachel to wife. Rachel being his sister, and he having the authority in a patriarch to give her permission to marry Jacob, and Jacob permission to marry his sister. People say, oh, that's so antiquated. We can't do that anymore. Well, today we do that. The thing is it's your guardian is not your brother or your father. It's the state. So you go ask permission, you get a license to get married. Now, you don't have to get that license, but if you don't go get that license and you want insurance at the business where you work, or you get in an automobile accident, she ends up going on the government dole, she's not going to get your Social Security. She's not going to get taken care of by the state with the same capacity that she would have if she had that marriage license. Now, some states will be different. But the point is people have traded the family patriarchy for the state patriarchy. This is a very, very foundational concept that goes back to the time of Rome, goes back to the time of early Israel. Everything goes back to Egypt, where the Pharaoh of Egypt was invested with a certain power over the people, where he had the right not only to your labor, but to the labor of your children. at least 20%. There was a cap put on it. 20% of your labor belonged to the government of Pharaoh forever, unless he set you free. That was what they consented to. And so that's, and by consent, they might be able to escape on a ship, cross the desert, run to the high countries beyond the Alps in Italy and up into the North Woods and escape that bondage. But they would have to escape it. They would have to flee beyond the jurisdiction of the Pharaoh. And he might just let you go because it's not worth chasing you. But then he might not let you go. Or like when Moses came, he was going to let them go, but he wasn't going to let the women and children go. We're going to keep the women and children, but you can go out to the desert and sacrifice to whoever you want. Instead of sacrificing to me every year, you can go sacrifice to whoever you want. And that's what Moses wanted. But Moses said, no, we're going to take the children and the wives. And this was part of that dispute. If you don't understand, they were trying to get out of bondage. And you can find actually other places in history where they conquered, you know, Julius Caesar conquered the Gauls, or numerous tribes of the Gauls. We named them in our article on Julius Caesar. And the way he had to conquer them, because they were very insistent fighters, and he claimed to have a right to fight them because there were charges against them abusing other Gauls, and they allied with the ones and attacked the other. Now, there were people who thought that he was unwarranted in what he was doing and thought that what he was doing was genocide, and they wanted to arrest him. But it actually never went anywhere, and we've told that story before. But the point was, he had to kill the men, the Gauls that were men, and take their wives and their children and sell them as slaves into bondage because they no longer had a patriarch to take care of them. And so now they were spoils of war. But he grew wealthy, and then, of course, this is one of the things he did. He took that wealth and bought free bread and feasts and welfare. He paid into the welfare system of Rome, take care of the needy. And so the people did not have the will to charge him with war crimes. Well, before they got to that point where the people were easily bought off, morals were bought off, their values were bought off, they had to descend into a state of mind that allowed them to be bought off, where they didn't stand fast in the righteousness that they knew was right. They had to degenerate into that. And there was a whole process to do that. So like I said, the Bible is about bondage. It's about liberty. And you're either in bondage under the men of the world or the sinful men of the world, or you're at liberty under God in what is proverbially called the kingdom of God, the dominion of God. So if you're under the dominion of God, you have all those rights that Thomas Jefferson talks about you being in endowed with by your creator, with certain inalienable rights. You have access to all those rights. People say, well, you can't take those rights away. Well, actually, it's done every day. People are put in prison. They have all their inalienable rights, but they're in a prison. And they can only do so. And every time you sign a contract, we'll go back to Jacob, because we've just been going through that study. He signed an agreement. I don't know if he actually signed any paper, but he made the agreement that if I work for you for 7 years, I get to marry your daughter, Rachel. And I don't know if he wrote it down. If he didn't write it down, that may explain why Laban switched on him and gave him Leah instead of Rachel. But then he still, I still want to marry Rachel. You've deceived me. He says, oh, well, I'm sorry. And he had excuses. And he said, if you work for me for another 7 years after your week alone with Leah on your honeymoon, then you can marry Rachel right away. You can marry Rachel right away. But you owe me 7 years of labor. Like I said during our study, he could have walked away from the deal originally during any time during that 7 years because there was no exchange. But now he was going to make an exchange. He was going to give him the daughter on the condition now that you have to fulfill a contract. You have to work for 7 years. Now see, Benjamin Franklin didn't keep that contract. When he made a contract, you teach me how to be a printer and I'll work for you for so many years. And it was probably 7 years. That's what I remember it as. And that's pretty standard. But he didn't fulfill that contract. He took off and he had, I think, just a few cents to his name. And he thought his brother had treated him ill. And I couldn't tell you if he did or not. But he thought, and he got a boat, went across the bay, and he bought a loaf of bread, or three loaves of bread for a penny. And then he went about to set up, what am I going to do for a living? Because I'm going to have to make more money. And that was the beginning of his private enterprise. And but he began it on a sour note, where he didn't finish his work with his brother. But now Jacob did finish the 7 years and fulfilled his contract. And then he offered Laban another contract that I will do this and this if you do this and this. And we've gone over that. You can go listen to our audios and read it in Genesis at preparingyou.com. But now the deal was he was going to have livestock, possessions. And with those livestock will come herdsmen who are working for him. Just as when he married Leah and Rachel, they brought handmaids. Those handmaids are now in the household, in the patriarchy of Jacob. They're under Jacob's authority. But Jacob is still under the authority of Laban because he's made another contract. 7 years to get payback for Rachel and another 7 years to pay back for the livestock that are naturally born that have spots and coloring. And so at the end of that time, he could leave with that livestock. And he could leave with Rachel and Leah and their servants and his servants that he had obtained along with the livestock. And he left with lots of people. Lots of people followed him out, and they were his possessions. And we talked about that, where they have this big long word that supposedly means, it's translated livestock, but it actually means possessions, his possessions. And his possessions were the people. And we went through where he was setting up a system where everybody would have access to heavenly inspiration. They would get to make choices. And we've talked about that before. If a man loses his right to make a choice, you know, like the man in prison or the man under a contract, he has to abide by the contract. He's lost some of his right to choose. And to whatever degree that is, he has become a thing, an instrument, and what they call a person. And we quoted Archibald MacLeish, who made that very clear back in the 30s, that if you give up your right to choose on certain aspects that normally you would have that right to choose, concerning those things, you're now bound. You may not be completely in bondage, and neither were the people that were in bondage in Egypt. They had 20% of their labor belonged to the government, but the other 80% of their labor was theirs. They weren't completely in bondage, but they were in bondage by consent. It was called voluntary servitude. And they ate of the benefits of that voluntary servitude, and so therefore they were bound until either the Pharaoh said they could go or somebody would redeem them. And of course, both things happened because Moses was a redeemer. Moses was the rightful Pharaoh, but he was saying to the Pharaoh that took his place when he left for those years, he's saying, you keep the stuff, but give me the people. And like I said, first he was going to give them the men, but not the women and children. He says, no, you got to give them all. And then, of course, it eventually ended up that he not only gave them all the women and children, but he also was blessed with all kinds of gold and silver and jewels and all their possessions that they could take. And we've explained in our study on Exodus, which is again available at Preparing You, that this was the strategy of God brought all this about. So when he said, let my people go, they went. And of course, now we've explained that there was a second Pharaoh. In one of our programs just recently, we talked about this, the second Pharaoh, because the Pharaohs, there it was a descendant of the Pharaoh, but it was the second son. The first son of the Pharaoh died when all the firstborn died, but the second son was already grown, and he ended up probably being the one that led the army to destroy the Israelites, because now they have no protector. The Pharaoh protected people all over Canaan. They had treaties with people all over Canaan. The Philistines, for a while, had a treaty with Egypt for Egypt to come to their aid if they were overwhelmed by somebody who attacked. In order to have that treaty, they had to pay tribute to Egypt every year. And then when they had a great need, we've talked about this in previous studies, when they had a great need, the Egyptians did not send an army to help defend them, and the Philistines were wiped out by their enemies. And all that tribute they paid went to naught. And of course, Bera, king of Sodom, was paying tribute to other kings. Then he decided not to, along with several other of the city-states, and then they came to collect what they thought was rightfully theirs. We live in a world of cause and effect. We live in a world of contracts, which is why in the Ten Commandments it says to make no covenants, which means contracts. Sometimes it's translated leagues with other people. And, of course, occasionally you might have to, but you'd have to look at the nature of these leagues. What they're talking about is those leagues, covenants, contracts, constitutions that take away some of the right to choose of the individual. Because that's how you go into bondage. It may be a little bit, but it may be the camel's nose under the tent. Before you know it, it's more and more and more, and you have less. As you see, government's gaining more and more power, more and more right to choose for you, the less right to choose you have. They get more powerful, you get less powerful, you get less liberty. Greatest destroyers of liberty are the givers of gifts, gratuities, and benefits. And there's a twofold reason, at least a twofold reason, why that is. Obviously, you've given them the right to choose. You know, today, if a girl and a boy, young man, wants to get married, the idea that he has to go and ask the girl's father is foreign to a vast number of people in the world. That used to be a part of the Judeo-Christian values, that you ask the father for the girl's... I mean, we even have it in the ceremonies. Who gives this bride away? But now, who gives it away is the state. they go to the state and ask permission to get a license. Now, some people say, well, we're not going to get a license. We're just going to live together. And we've already gone over a little bit why that may put your wife at a disadvantage if something happens to you. Because she will become completely a ward of the state. And, of course, this is why so many women today don't know what it means to be a wife or even to be a mother. And many young men don't know what it means to be a husband, to be the patriarch of a society. You know, and they have, and now the idea of the patriarch is a bad thing, everybody thinks. But there's still a patriarch. It's just the state is now your father. And of course, Jesus said, call no man on earth father, but my father in heaven. And of course, I've actually seen preachers doing Bible studies where that mean where they actually say you're not supposed to call your natural father father, but only God. Meanwhile, the same preacher giving that sermon depends entirely upon the state for his health care, his Medicare, his Medicaid, his social welfare, the social safety net of his family is the state, which is provided under the phrase parens patria. You know, the parents, the state as your parent, as both father and mother, and we'll get into that. Anyway, so one of the first questions I have here, what did we learn in Isaiah 9? What does it have to do with the righteousness of Jesus and the gospel of the kingdom? Now, that's in the recording of Genesis 35. We went over some of that and the first part of it, and that will be up at preparingyou.com under Genesis 35, and you can go back and review that. But Isaiah, what was in Isaiah 9? What were they talking about in Isaiah 9 that we could even make a reference to that in the context of liberty under God and the bait of bondage, etc.? It talks in the second verse about the people walked in darkness. Jesus talks about the people sitting in darkness. It talks about the rod of his oppressor and the yoke of his burden in verse 4. What are they talking about? And the burning and fuel of fire they talk about in verse 5. But we're not going to go through all, but then they talk about a child being born, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And of course, this is a reference supposedly to Jesus. And immediately in the next verse, they talk about him upon the throne of David. And of course, Jesus is hailed as he comes into Jerusalem as the highest son of David. And of course, that's part of that prophecy made many, many years earlier in Isaiah 9. And it goes on and it talks about the word coming to Jacob. And of course, that's what we covered a little bit, both in the last several chapters as well as chapter 35 of Genesis. And so there's a lot more to it, and we'll eventually, but eventually they talk about the leaders in error. What error is that the leaders are? Talks about hypocrites and evildoers by verse 17. Well, the error is the error of Balaam, which is in the New Testament is the error of the Nicolaitans. And of course, in the New Testament, it tells you that the error of the Nicolaitans is the same as the error of Balaam. So we have links that show you what the error of Balaam is. So what does this have to do with the bait of bondage? Well, Nicolaitans are conquered people. What conquers them? Does an army come in and put a knife to their throat and say, submit or die? Because if that's the deal, submit or die, then the first opportunity you get to escape, you can escape with no contractual obligation. because they coerced you into agreeing. They need your consent. And this is why the Bible talks so much about consent. So how do they get your consent? They offer you something, which is why I quoted Plutarch just a few minutes ago. The greatest destroyers of liberty are the givers of gifts, gratuities, and benefits. They offer you free bread. They offer you free health care. Of course, it's not free. It's got to be provided at the expense of somebody. You know, the original Pharaoh was providing it at his expense because he had been storing grain based on Joseph's advice for 7 years. And so he had, you know, more than enough grain to share with other people. But he shared it on the deal that you will give 20% of your labor. And of course, such offers have been made in America and in Canada and in England and in France and in China. Even China, I wrote about this years ago when they had the one-child contract, which was short-lived. It was devastating to the population of China. But they ended up many years later finding out there were a lot more girls in the countryside than were on the census rolls. Because they weren't telling the people about all the girl babies. They were hiding them. I actually know of a guy who, I think he lived in China. He made sewing machines, had a huge family. I think it was at least 9 children. And you thought, well, how does he have 9 children? And this is after the one-child contract. Why does he get to have 9 children? And so many other people are limited to only 1. Because you had to sign a one-child contract to be held to that. They didn't just say, it's against the law to have 2 children. They said, if you have 2 children, if you have 1 child, you will get all kinds of gifts, gratuities, and benefits. Free education, extra allowance for shoes and clothing and food, all these things that are normally rationed to their population. But you have to sign that you agree that you're only going to have 1 child. And lots of people signed because they needed that benefit that was not freely given, but given under condition. And then when the woman found herself pregnant, sometimes she tried to hide the pregnancy, and there'd be people on her own block that would turn her in, and they would grab her, and they would hold her down, and they would abort her child. Now, they could get out of that abortion. All they had to do is pay back all those benefits that had been given them for their first child. Well, most people couldn't afford that. But this guy who made sewing machines, had a whole factory of guys working for him. He was a great machinist. He knew how to do it. I actually own one of his sewing machines. And it's basically a Singer sewing machine, but it can sew leather. And so it can use the old Singer needles and all that stuff. And I can run it with a motor or with a treadle. And he made it in China. I met one of his daughters. And he had lots of kids. He never signed the one-child contract. So the bait is usually a benefit. Either a benefit of protection, because that's what a lot of the people who were out there in Canaan, you know, out there, you know, as far as where Israel was headed, a lot of those people out there had the protection of the Egyptian army. If you attack this city-state or that city-state and it's paying tribute to Egypt, Egypt will send an army after the guys that attack you. And so they don't attack you. And that's one of the ways they extended their jurisdiction, by contract. But Israel, with Moses, had no such contract. So they were fair game. And so this other pharaoh, who was part of the whole pharaoh You have to understand how the pharaoh system worked. They were very compartmentalized. There was a head pharaoh, but there's always, you know, like a pharaoh who's also a general and another pharaoh who might be in charge of building dams and repairing dams and everything. But and they're usually family. But this other pharaoh is probably the one that attacked Moses. And there's, you know, of course, we find those chariot wheels at the bottom of the Red Sea. Not at the very bottom, but across where they supposedly crossed. So, again, back to this idea of the bait and the bondage is this idea of they offer you something, some sort of benefit. And, of course, Proverbs talks about that. You know, the dainties, you know, of rulers. And if you have an appetite for the dainties of rulers, and everybody has a little bit of that appetite, some people gorge themselves on it, others don't want to take it at all. That it says in Proverbs that if you have that appetite for the dainties of rulers, put a knife to your throat, because he serves deceitful meat. So that's the bait. If he says, let's all have one purse, and it says, lurk privately for blood. This is in Proverbs also. You know, consent not. You know, because it is your blood that will be shed in that agreement, in that consent. See, if you desire benefits at the expense of your neighbor, that's not loving your neighbor. That's coveting your neighbor's goods. Now, that's done everywhere today in all those countries I mentioned, in, you know, the United States and Canada and Great Britain and Australia and South America. And, of course, some countries that they don't offer you very many benefits, but the more prosperous or theoretic, apparently prosperous country, the more benefits they offer you. Free health care! It's not free. Somebody's got to pay. And they have to get that pay by men who exercise authority going to your neighbors and taking something away from your neighbor that he produced to provide you with those free benefits. You know, and Plutarch, he had also written in 100 AD that the man who first ruined the Roman people, 'twas he who was first gave them treats and gratuities. But this mischief crept secretly and gradually in and did not openly make its appearance in Rome for a considerable time. Well, that was that process that began at least 150 years earlier, when Polybius was warning Romans. He was a Corinthian, but he was literally kind of under a prisoner. He was actually a hostage from Corinth to keep Corinth from breaking rules that they had agreed to in those leagues and treaties. They're breaking rules. It was just a big treaty. I haven't read it yet. It was just a big treaty supposedly signed between the nation we call Israel over there in the Middle East and Hamas. And they were somewhat coerced, although not the kind of coercion where you could say, I don't have to do this because you coerced me. It was the coercion that supposedly Netanyahu, if you don't sign this, if you don't stop being stubborn and agree to these, I think it was 20 points, that we're going to withdraw our support, our military support and aid that we've been sending you. And the same with Hamas. He says, if you don't sign this, we're going to let Netanyahu do whatever he wants with you. And somebody said, and you'll get your, whatever it is, 67, 76 virgins before the end of the month. So, I don't know. Somebody was saying something to that effect. You get the drift. The point is all hell's going to break loose because we're not going to stand in between you two fighting, trying to keep the peace. if neither one of you wants the peace. Now, they're signing the agreement. And of course, Netanyahu says, how do we know they're going to keep it? Well, you can almost bet that somebody over there isn't going to keep it. But then, how do you know that the Israelis are going to keep all their part of these 20 points? I don't even know what they are, so I don't know. The government, the head government might want to keep it, but then you've got to deal with Mossad. Mossad's doing a lot of things behind the scenes, always have. I mean, that's their kind of secret police, and it has defended them many times, but it doesn't always have the same Judeo-Christian values that a lot of us would consider to be righteous. Certainly, they're not acting like Christ. Neither side is acting much like Christ. Neither side is acting much like Abraham. Certainly, neither side is acting like Jacob. They're acting like Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, who went and killed everybody in the city of Sychem. They murdered them all and took their, not the women and children, they took them as slaves. But it was genocide for all the men. And they weren't Israel. They were sons of Jacob, but they weren't Israel because they didn't have the values of Jacob. You know, we talk about Judeo-Christian values. Well, let's talk about Abrahamic and Jacob values. They didn't have those. And they still don't, as far as I can see. And we can get into that conversation if somebody who comes up with a question wants to know about that. There's the people who had once bestowed commands, counselship, legions, and all else now longs eagerly for just two things, bread and circuses. Now, that's a quote from Juvenal, a Roman poet, about the same time as Plutarch. Same time as Claudius and Claudia in the Bible. Juvenal had an infatuation with Claudia and wrote about her, and she's mentioned in the Bible. But I don't want to get off track here. But the point is that the people of Rome did not know what made Rome great. There probably was certain people seeking to be the emperor, suggesting let's make Rome great again. But they didn't know what made Rome great originally. What made it powerful? What it made it so invincible? And we've gone through study after study in many of our recordings showing how Rome began to change their own value. The original Roman culture that allowed them to defeat all opposition and rise in wealth and accomplishments was degenerating because they changed some of their values. And they began to develop that appetite for benefits received at the expense of others. Maybe Corinthians, because they received a great deal of wealth from the Corinthians when they destroyed the Corinthian city and leveled it to the ground. And then, of course, we saw it with the Gauls. They killed almost 1 million Gauls and sold their wives and children into slavery and made a fortune. And they were okay with that. They'd become accustomed to living at the expense of others and depending for their livelihood on the property of others. And this caused them to degenerate as a society. And how do we see that degeneration? Breakdown of the family. Gender dysphoria, where, you know, homosexuality, transvestites, everything began to show up more and more in the society, even in the military. This was getting to be more and more common. And of course, that was only common when they went to the point of making rules about marriage of military soldiers, of other people. You couldn't marry outside of your station and all these things. But they also saw a decline in birth rate. All these things we're seeing today, and people are trying to figure out what's causing it. Well, it's a loss of values. And that loss of values comes from, produces two things. A loss of rights, a decrease in rights, and then, of course, accompanying that, decrease in the right to choose, because that's one of those rights, the right to choose how much I'm going to give to charity, how much I'm going to give to the military, how much I'm going to give. And a lot of people today would say, well, that's impossible. You can't run a country like that. There's no way you're going to do it. Israel did it. Israel did it for hundreds of years. And they were pretty invincible. And every time they strayed from those principles of the kingdom of God and the perfect law of liberty, they began to degenerate more until they wanted a king. First, they wanted a king. They didn't want a king for, you know, to get welfare and Medicare, Medicaid, and all that. They just wanted somebody to help fight their army, you know, and organize their army. And, of course, Rome had gone through this same process even before Julius Caesar. And with every step, as Plutarch is saying, creeping in to the people's thinking, the people's practices, the people's activities, they got farther and farther away from that thing that made Rome great, which was the rugged individualism, the sacrifice for one another, the camaraderie of families and family groups, the time that it took. They formed what they call hearths, which was usually 12 families would gather together. Now, exactly the structure, it was probably 10 families, and then the family of the equestrian or whoever it was who was considered their minister of those 10 families, and then who he chose. So it was probably almost identical to the tens, hundreds of thousands that was set up by Moses and Joshua for Israel. And or because that's not, I mean, you can go all the way back to Babylon, and such a pattern existed. It existed in free governments, and it also existed in Babylon. But Babylon, you didn't choose who was going to be the leader, not ruler, but leader. In the Hebrew, it would be Sar, Shin, Resh, because he's just a leader. He's not a Shin, Resh, Resh. You still have a right to choose, just as you choose him as your leader, but on a very localized basis. And then that leader gets together and chooses. He gets together with 9 others like himself, and he chooses a leader. So there comes your 12. And that 12, because each one is, you can multiply that out, so there's at least 10 12s like that, and there's actually more. So it ends up being quite a few people. I haven't done the math, so I can't tell you exactly what it is. But the bait is, I want to get something for nothing. I want to get something, and I turn a blind eye to how I'm going to get it. I didn't go to my neighbor's house and take it away. Somebody else did. And so therefore, my eyes are darkened, dimmed. This is how you get to sit in darkness. Because every time you deny the fact that applying for benefits from men who exercise authority one over the other, every time you do that, your eyes are dimmed more. Because you're denying the truth. That's a covetous practice. That is covetousness. That is idolatry. Bible tells us it is in the New Testament. Paul tells us it's a snare and a trap. Jesus tells us not to covet our neighbor's goods, but to love our neighbor, using a word that means charity. Be charitable to your neighbor. Take care of your neighbor. Pure religion, according to James, unspotted by the constitutional order and system of government, is desiring to provide by your choice for the needy of society, the widows and orphans, the needy of society, you know, sick, infirmed, etc., through free will offerings. That's your choice. You have to choose to do it. In order to choose to do it, you have to gather together to know who it is that needs help. And you hope that if you ever need help, that they will be there for you. But you don't start gathering when you need help, because you're not coming in the name of Christ. You're coming in the name of people who are coming from welfare. All the problems today, the excessive number of illegal immigrants in the United States, and the conflict between all those people that are, you know, out there, the Antifa, and the guys trying to round up these illegal aliens. All this is directly the result of social welfare through the state, which has weakened not only the individual, but the family. Because people aren't dependent upon families anymore. They're dependent upon the government. See, if all the families were gathered together in the tens, hundreds, and thousands, you would be going to church because you know that if something happens, I'm going to need the people of this church to help me out. And, of course, I've heard this from a lot of, you know, home churches and small church groups. They say, yeah, but if somebody were to get cancer, the church would be wiped out. We wouldn't have any more money. It's more than we can handle. Because you're not thinking kingdom. Kingdom is thousands of congregations linked in a network of love and charity. In order to create that, you have to come like Christ. You have to come together to serve. You don't come together to find saints. You hope you find saints. But you come together to sacrifice yourself for the good of others. Now, people will do it with animals. I see old people doing it all the time with animals, but they won't do it with their neighbor. Why is that? They got animosity towards their neighbor. Oh, the neighbor does this and the neighbor does that. And, you know, I mean, the cats and the dogs and the horses and all their pets, they may do it with them too. But they are forgiving of that. But they're not forgiving of their brother, which Jesus talks about, Raka, Raka. So anyway, I go on to talk about the fact that, you know, the altars, Jacob is told to build an altar. That's what it says. And when we were reading in Isaiah 9, it says that God would visit Jacob and tell him. And of course, he is creating an altar. And we've explained just recently how he was also creating booths so that all these people following him would have their own tents. They didn't sleep in some sort of common slave tent. They were in their own families. And Jacob saw the essentialness of the family. Of course, he was raised with Isaac. He was raised around Abraham. He understood what these things were. You know, like I went through, you know, the age of Jacob when a lot of these events happened. And, of course, Abraham was already gone. But Isaac was still there when he came back to where Abraham had been. When he came back to the home of Isaac, Isaac was still alive. He was alive for another dozen years or more. And so he came back and saw his father. Now, we don't have recorded conversations and all that stuff, but we know that he went to visit Isaac. Now, the reality is he's also building these altars. And people would have you believe that it was about, you set up the altar, then you go get a sheep or a red heifer, and you go over and you kill it, and you pile it up on the stones, and you set it on fire. But they don't understand that these altars of clay and stone were systems of social welfare. They were the social safety nets. They were burnt up offerings to them, turned over to the stones of the altar, the lively stones that we see mentioned in 1 Peter 2:5. They were always lively stones. But for years and years and years, although you'll find some rabbis talking about it, a lot of people have been saying, oh no, you just make these stones and you pile them up and you burn up sheep on them, or you burn a red heifer, and then you take the ashes. They unmoor the meaning of the scriptures so that you don't realize that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob were seeking the ways of Christ. And that the stones of the altars were always lively stones. And the offerings were always to take care of the needy, whether they were widows and orphans and people who were injured in battle, or they were just people who fell on hard times in the community. And you could even overflow into people who are not a part of your network, the stranger in your midst. So if you came across an illegal immigrant in America, I've done this, you can help them out. Back when I worked on Onion Radish Farms in Simi Valley half a century ago, we'd have illegal aliens working for us, and that came across and wanted a job, and we would help them out, and they worked hard. They didn't go on welfare. They didn't come for the EBT cards. They came to work, and they came to learn the language, and they did. And they became good Americans, an asset to the community, rather than something that was depleting it. Well, this is how immigration took place for years and years and years, and we can get into that discussion at another time. Teaching, I don't want to use the word doctrine, that's so misused, but we have a very clear theme that we're talking about. If you go to our X space at Preparing You, there's some notes there. We have a Christian checklist there. We have articles, Christian conflict, the early church, the church in the wilderness, the perfect law of liberty, covetous practices that make men merchandise. Why I say the bait and the bondage is that the bait is the benefits, the gifts, gratuities, and even protection. Protection draws subjection. That's an ancient maxim of law. So if they're protecting you from poverty, if they're protecting you supposedly from disease, protecting you from criminals, protecting you from foreign invading armies, they're doing it. And when I say they, I'm talking about the men who call themselves benefactors, who are maybe rulers, leaders, rulers, what have you. But they exercise authority one over the other. They don't give you anything except what they took away from somebody else. Yeah, it looks like Mark's got his hand up. Okay.
Yeah, hi, Brother Gregory. Just a quick observation. You know, we've got a sea of these modern Christians who have good intentions. You know, they want to be good people. You know, and when they see something they're doing wrong, you know, if they perceive they're sinning in a certain way, usually they're very superficial type sins, but they repent from them, and they want to do the right thing generally. The observation I'm making is that it's kind of like an educational problem where they need to be educated as to sins that they don't realize they're doing, such as they knew of in the olden American days, guys like Davy Crockett and guys like this that would, you know, outline these sins of socialism, you know, whereas today, you know, the right wing or the conservatives or whatever you want to call it, Christian bloc, are so far left of what they used to be, you know. Today's Republicans are like yesterday's Democrats, in a sense, or whatever, and yesterday's Democrats are much more conservative than today's Republicans, all that type of thing. So the whole Overton window has moved to the left, if you like, socialism, and that people are sort of being boiling like frogs in a pot, and they don't realise that they're very socialist. But, you know, if you ask any modern Christian, do you think socialism is good, they'll say no. They'll think it's evil, but they don't realise that they're socialists themselves, you know?
Absolutely. So, I mean, public education is very clearly a socialist system. I mean, like, we have an article, the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto. So, I mean, basically, you look up Communist Manifesto. All 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto are law in the United States today. But we're back in Babylon, but it's mystery Babylon because they can't see it. Like you say, it's about education. And, of course, that's what we're trying to do, is educate people. But it's also about being willing to see the truth when somebody shares it with you. And, of course, we've got hundreds of articles that go through these things step by step. I mean, you can go read the Communist Manifesto at preparingyou.com, and we show you that all 10 planks, the banking system, centralized bank, you know, I mean, this way the Bible tells you just weights and measures. Notes are not just weights and measures. They're notes. They're promises. They're pledges to pay, and they've changed the pledge. They're not going to pay you. I mean, we go through the whole history of this somewhere in the hundreds of recordings that we have so that people can learn that. But basically, why I'm breaking it back in your Davy Crockett, we have an article in Davy Crockett. I should put the link in for that. The reality is that they knew, Americans knew. Davy didn't realize it. It took Horatio Bonds to tell him, says, what you're talking about, what you voted for, is not moral. I can't vote for you again because you did that. And he explained himself. And it wasn't just that he explained it, because you can read the explanation in the article that we have posted at Preparing You on Davy Crockett. But Davy Crockett was willing to see that what the idea of taking money by taxes and providing welfare was immoral. And moral people didn't want to elect anybody who thought that that was good. But that was back in the 1800s. Lots have happened. And finally, when we got, it wasn't until, I think, the 70s. Although, you know, I could track back, probably find where some people were quoting this, where somewhere along the line, just in the last century, that it was accepted that general welfare, accepted by the Supreme Court, general welfare now could mean specific welfare. And there's a reason, there's actually a logical way of thinking why the Supreme Court would make such a ruling. Because people had already voted to have one purse, which we go back to Proverbs, where it says, if sinners entice ye to say, let's all have one purse, consent not. What they're talking about is all your gold is supposedly in Fort Knox or somewhere. It's not in your pockets. Even the gold you might have in your pockets, you only have a legal title to. But it's just layers and layers. We've gotten farther and farther away. And we do go through and explain all the details in article after article. But the basic is that the modern American Christian, the modern Canadian Christian, modern Australian Christian, and the same for the Jews and the Muslims as well, have all accepted that it's okay to covet your neighbor's goods through men who exercise authority one over the other. And that it's okay to take a bite out of your neighbor as long as you use the teeth of government, of a democracy, to do it. Then it's not you biting them. But it is. And it's because we don't see it because we have lost Judeo-Christian values, whatever the heck that's supposed to mean. I have an article up that tries to explain it. And we are going against the teachings of Abraham, Moses, and Jesus Christ. I mean, Jesus Christ made it so clear. You're not to be like the governments of the Gentiles who call themselves benefactors, but exercise authority one over the other. That's basically what he says in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And it should be simple for them to see. But they can't see it a lot of times because their ears are full of the ticklings of false ministers. And because they sit in darkness, they don't want to see it. It's not, you're right, they need education. They need knowledge. Yay, but for the lack of knowledge. They need knowledge they don't have. But unfortunately, many will not accept that knowledge because they don't love the light. They don't want to know the truth. When I first began to realize the truth, I would share it with people. And they were so depressed by it. They were upset by it. They thought, this is so negative. No, it's the truth. It should... But I always wanted to know the truth. At least some of the truth. I'm sure there's some truths I may stumble at yet. And I hope that God gives me the grace to see those truths too. But you can try to educate them all you want. If they don't want to know it, they will come up with an excuse. But very good point. I will try to put that. I see somebody else has got their hand up. Did you have something else you wanted to say, Mark? We'll go to the other hand.
Oh, look, I do have a follow-up observation, but we'll go to the other hand first, and then I'll go after that.
Okay, that sounds good. So there's Keta Wall something. I don't have the whole name here. Yeah, go ahead.
It's Christy at Atwell.
Oh, okay, Air, so right. I'm going to have to recognize
Cat,
that.
Atwell Air, so I kind of...
Is that Christy with a K?
Yes.
Okay, so that's okay. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And so I wanted to go back over the Davy Crockett thing. I remember you bringing that up before. So was it that he was in dispute of the government wanting to spend money for fires that had happened?
Well, you say he, Horatio Bunce didn't think that that was a good idea. And Horatio Bunce was in the district that Davy Crockett was running for office in. And he'd already been elected once. And when there was this terrible fire in Washington, D.C., they said we need to give him relief. And all the people in the Congress at that time voted to take money out of, you know, the Treasury, the money that was at the disposal of the government, to help out those burn victims. And Horatio Bunce said that that's immoral and it's destructive to the what's making America great, so to speak. I mean, you can read his words, which is taken from an article written back in those days, quoting Horatio Bunce when he was still around to say, well, that's not what I said, but evidently it is what he said. And he explained to David Crockett that I can't vote for you because that's not the purpose of tax money, to become common welfare for individuals. He thinks that we need to help them out, but it has to be done by charity. And of course, I could also put in an article we have on Lady Godiva, who is the picture of Lady Godiva is on the Free Church Report. Why would you put a picture of Lady Godiva? I always like this story. I was in front of half a dozen or more pastors at a retreat, and they had literally dragged me down there to speak. And so I showed them some of the books that I had written, and I picked up, and this is the Free Church Report. And it's pretty controversial, but it has a picture of Lady Godiva on it. Of course, that's facing me. And then I slowly start to turn it around so that they can see it. And some of the pastors are putting their hands over their eyes because they don't want to see Lady Godiva naked because they've never seen Lady Godiva wearing clothes. And the reality of the story, if you read the article, is Lady Godiva never took her clothes off. It was that story is a total fabrication, a product of a monk who wanted to do what she was actually in opposition to, which was to support the poor and education and hospitals with tax dollars. Because the king was saying that the other governors, the other lords in England, and she was married to one who was actually a Norman. Her husband had died many years before. And she had married this Norman as a widow, but she was one of the wealthiest women in England. She's the only woman in England mentioned in the Doomsday Book because she was so wealthy. She owned so much property. But her husband, who was wealthy from Normandy, because he was a Norman, he was told or commanded, he had taken an oath of allegiance to the king, to collect a tax to be used for the poor. And of course, in those days, to use it for the poor, they were going to start a FEMA group or anything. They were going to give the money to the church, which at that time was becoming the Catholic Church. Christianity had been in England for a long time, but the Catholic Church was now cornering the market on what a church was, the long process of that happening. But anyway, she said, we can't do that. We can't help the poor with tax money. We have to help the poor with charity. Because, and this is right on point, you need the choices that come with operating social welfare through charity that are taken from you when you're taking care of the needy through government. Government will now have the choice. You don't have the choice. You don't get to make the choice to sacrifice your 10 bucks, your 100 bucks, your 10 hours of time, your extra food. You've given up that choice to the government, and the government will make that choice for you. So those two articles, Davy Crockett and Lady Godiva, David Crockett and Lady Godiva, if I said it right, are very good examples of what made America great. The principle of, which was a Judeo-Christian value, where you took care of the needy through charity. The word charity shows up nowhere in the Old Testament in the translations, but the word korban itself is the Hebrew word for free will offering, a free will sacrifice. Right. And so that's a Judeo value, to take care of the widows and orphans through a free will sacrifice. It's a Nimrodic value. It's a despot value. It's a city of blood value, to take care of the needy through forced taxation. And as Polybius says, if you do it that way, it will degenerate the people the more their appetite increases. And so what we see in the political scene is we've got Democrats over here who have a ravenous appetite and a bunch of Republicans over here that have too much of an appetite. And some of the people that are on the Republican side actually have almost no appetite. So the division is not between Republican and Democrat. It's the division that only comes with the smoking furnace and burning lamp, where on one side you have offerings that are the result of charity, and the other side you have offerings that are a result of force. And Jesus makes it very clear that his followers are not to be like the governments who exercise authority, in other words, use force to call so that they can call themselves benefactors. But they are to have leaders, not rulers, leaders, ministers, who don't exercise authority, but exercise love. It's the only way to get your rights back, is to build such a network. Go ahead.
Yeah, and Mark's point about people not realizing what they're doing wrong, and I think that the emotional pull, I think that the adversary uses our emotions to bring that into the effect that we feel so bad for people, we want our tax money to go for that, and that's what's happening today. I actually looked up today, an old pastor that I had is giving a talk to a university, I think Dallas, or a junior college or something, about giving to 501c3 nonprofit organizations and how great it is. And I looked up the amounts that we spent in 2019 when we were having difficulties, and we reached out to a few charities, and unless you're already getting what you can from the government, which in our case for my son was $400 a month, which barely covered groceries, they get $2.7 trillion in welfare in 1 year from our tax money. And $450 billion we gave as Americans to charities. And the help is just not there. It's not being used in that way. So emotionally we say we should give tax money to help people. But that's enough money to give the 67 million people who were helped $49,000 a year.
Right. Yeah. I just heard the statistic today, California schools get $26,000 per student. The classes are, generally speaking, 30 students in size. So multiply that $26,000 times 30, and you get a huge sum.
Right.
The building, there's no tax on the building. And the building's already built in most cases. There's probably some maintenance and everything. But between the maintenance and the teacher's salary and even the teacher's pension, the vast majority of the money set aside isn't even there. It goes somewhere right. else. Where does it go? Where is all that money being spent? And the same way with the charities. Of the USAID, most of the money going to USAID never went to even some of the crazy things that it was supposed to be going to. It disappeared in the bureaucracy. And and the fact is, you have no control over that, because we have fallen prey to the idea that the government should provide us with welfare. And the reality is that you can do a way better job if people would simply gather together. We've taken care of people most of the time, because we don't have any big, we have taken care of people here on this place, but most of the time we do it in their homes with the local people here. And, you know, we've had, and the only time we get to do it is when they ask, and when the government dumps them out because they're about to die. And, you know, wow. I give the example of an old guy who I knew for years and years and years. And I won't go through the whole story, but they gave him 3 days to live. And we took over his care. And, I mean, I learned fascinating things in this process about evil and about wellness and everything else. But he lived a very high-quality life, considering all the damage that was already done to him. He was healing every day. Bed sores disappeared. Sores from operations disappeared that were, they said, would kill him in a matter of days. And all under our care. And the government would come in and check on him, and they kept saying they wanted to pay us for the services we were providing. And I says, you know, basically I told them, I don't know where you got your money. And I would have to know where you got the money. Because I knew I would not take pay from them. We could do that on a grand scale. But it takes people that are actually going to step out of the boat on faith and start depending not. And this is, of course, what we talked about in Jacob, just in Jacob 35, is that they had to take all those things, those strange gods, those idols, those things that connected them to these other sources of protection and welfare, and bury them under an oak. Of course, it didn't have anything to do with the oak tree, but it had to do with trusting in God, because the oak is the representative of a spiritual trust in God. And of course, almost immediately the verse is that he was now traveling through the land, journeying through the land, and all the states round about him that could have attacked him after the heinous genocide of his sons against Shechem were afraid to attack him. Why? Because God instilled fear into them. We just are not living by faith. People think faith is believing an idea up here in their tree of knowledge. Faith is walking according to the leading of the Holy Spirit. And I can guarantee that the Holy Spirit has not been the one leading us to men who call themselves benefactors but exercise authority. That's an unholy spirit that has led us to that. And they led us to a lot of other things and a lot of other ideas that is degenerating our society. So there is a huge confusion amongst us. We sit in darkness and we don't see the light. But if we just move a little bit towards the light in some of these little ways, like gathering in tens and start caring about 9 other people as much as you care about yourself, caring about their family as much as you care about your own family, that's going to open a door that will bring in light that you can't imagine. And the farther you go in that direction towards the light, the more you will see what you did was wrong before. But you're not going to be ridden with guilt because you're on your way back to the light. And the God we serve is a God of forgiveness. He's not a God of guilt. He's not going to be, you know, I mean, you go to a lot of religions. I don't want to pick on any particular ones, but we can find it on the Christian side and the Jewish side and the Muslim side, that they control the people with guilt. You broke the rules. You've done this terrible thing. But they themselves are workers of iniquity. And they're leading people into bondage again. And of course, that's one of those things. It's pretty easy to say. If the bondage of Egypt was 20% of your labor belonged to the government, and all your property you only had legal title to, you didn't own it, that was the bondage of Egypt. And you couldn't go anywhere without being in that bondage of Egypt. And that's pretty much where it is today. I mean, you can say, well, I'm going to get out of America. I'm going to get out of this bondage in America. Where are you going to go? If you had $40,000 to invest, you could go live in St. Croix. And they don't have the income tax that we have here. And you'd be free from a huge amount of taxes. And they will give you a passport and you go all over. But St. Croix is under the crown of England. And so you haven't left anything. You've just found a place that is a little bit more benevolent, which is kind of like choosing between Democrat and Republican. Yeah, Republicans, if you look at the charitable giving of Republicans, it's far in excess on a per capita basis as the charitable giving of Democrats. Now, I'm not condemning Democrats. I'm just saying that's a statistic, a data observation. But the giving in the kingdom of God is far in excess of what Republicans do. Because the Republicans, I mean, they say right out, they're not going to. I don't want the president to do away with Social Security. But I will tell you, Social Security will disappear. I will tell you that Medicare, Medicaid will disappear. And hopefully it disappears before everybody takes another round of the new vaccinations they're working on. but there's a lot coming, and our only salvation is Christ, but it has to be the real Christ and what Christ did and what he was preaching. And like I say, it's really easy. You're not supposed to be coveting. Paul says coveting your neighbor's goods. And I'm going to bring up a point here that I thought of when you were talking, Christy, is that coveting your neighbor's goods is idolatry. because covetousness is idolatry. But also, we talk about the money that we, you know, we want the money we paid into our taxes to go to this charity or that charity or this good work or that good work. The reality is, if we open the books, all the money you pay in to taxes goes to paying the interest on the loan that actually provides the benefits. The entire system is operating in the red. There is no money that you pay in taxes that actually goes to charity. It all goes to pay the interest on the loan. The debt is going up. You can go find, you know, the debt clock, and you can just see it rising so fast you can't even read the numbers. That might as well call it the doomsday clock. I think some people do call it that. But the reality is that we have to repent. We're so far gone, there's no way back. Absolutely no way back. We cannot save ourselves. But God can save us. We're not going to suddenly pay the debt. But, you know, when I first started this many, many years ago, people were asking, well, how do you get out of the system? And I said, well, I mean, it tells you right in the law. There are four ways. And I've watched over the last 50 years as one option after another disappears because nobody acted. Everybody was clinging to their ear-tickling churches and ear-tickling doctrines or you know, dealing with, you know, other things, family, business, all the things that distract us in the world. And one after another, those options have been disappearing. Eventually we're going to be down to the final option. The only way out is the destruction of the entire trust property. And that's why I say, and people hear me say it, as it's eventually everybody's going to be free. Just not everybody's going to survive freedom. And we just, you know, and people ask, if we go this way, where is it going to take us? Well, it's going to take us at least down to the shores of the Red Sea with all the armies of the world, the World Economic Forum, whatever you want to call it, Pharaoh, whatever you want to call it, coming down on us with everything they got to destroy us. And nothing between us and them but the power of God. Now, exactly how that's going to play out visually, Cecil B. DeMille's had a picture of what that looked like. I don't think it was 100% accurate, but in principle, that's where we're going. And that's a walk of faith. But you're either going to continue with an appetite for benefits and the habit of receiving them at the expense of others, or you're going to learn what it means to love your neighbor as yourself. And that's what Christ came to teach us. That's what Moses came to teach us. And that's what Abraham and Jacob were trying to learn. And that's what the sons of Jacob failed to learn. And I can guarantee you, whatever those 20 points in that peace treaty between Israel and Hamas are, that is not the answer. It's fine if it stops the killing right now. I guess trucks are rolling in there with supplies and food and everything. But the reason Hamas is in power is because Gaza has been a welfare state for years and years and years. And welfare states weaken the people. And it creates, you know, it breaks down the family. And the bonds that make a strong family. And so the only answer is the solution that we're talking about here, which is those lively stones, those altars of clay and stone, those living altars where you have a social safety net depending upon charity. That's how you get your rights back. That's how you get your responsibilities back. And as you practice those rights and responsibilities, instead of covetous practices or slothful practices, you know, it's not just covetousness that brings us into bondage. The Bible tells us clearly, the slothful shall be under tribute. Slothful in what? Slothful in caring for one another. And that means slothful in gathering together. Everybody who resists the idea of gathering in groups, family groups of 10, is resisting Christ. And postponing the free bread of Christ. The Eucharist of Christ. They're postponing the Eucharist of Christ. Because Christ said there isn't going to be any bread. Basically, this is what he's saying. There's not going to be any bread until they sit down in the tens, hundreds, and thousands. And once they did that, then he took the little tiny bit of bread that the ecclesia, his ministers had there, and he says, go give this out to the people. And then suddenly, somehow or other, there was enough. And to get, what was it, 5,000 men and their families, 20,000, 30,000 people, to sit down in the tens, hundreds, and thousands, that's going to be a miracle. And it goes back to Mark's question. I see Mark's got his hand up. Thank you, Christy, for your comments. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, so bringing it back to the altars, so I think one of the staples that, you know, keeps the people in bondage, and I'll especially direct this at modern Christians once again, is that they have a state altar that they're contributing to right now, and they don't know there's an alternative because they think that the altars of Abraham and Moses were what Jewish or Judaism explains them to be, which was what the Pharisees were explaining them to be, by the way. And so if they knew there was an alternative, I think that what they see Jesus and his disciples were doing, they'll see that as reinstating that kind of altar that, you know, is supported by charity rather than force. And so, what? Just in summary, I know you've written about this in your books in much more detail, but just for the sake of the recording and the audience that may listen, what was the procedure that changed the minds of the people, you know, maybe in the translation of the Old Testament or whatever, that created this image of what the altars were rather than what they actually were, which kind of hid that idea from future generations and has almost hidden the idea forever? What was the procedure? Was it the translators that, you know, was it Ptolemy that, you know, told the 70 translators to translate the wrong ideas, or what do you think was the process? And, you know, just a general summary of the whole dynamic behind that that hid that idea of the altars of God from the people. That, you know, I think that's, you know, believing in a false idea is what keeps people in this bondage. Do you sort of get what I'm saying?
Right. And absolutely. And of course, I've made reference to the fact, and so did other people like Plutarch, that it creeps in. It doesn't just happen overnight. It has to creep in. So they get you to accept one little thing that doesn't have a tremendous effect, especially things like, you know, when they created a Federal Reserve, which didn't do away with gold and silver coins. Most transactions were still gold and silver coins. And the Federal Reserve was now going to present these notes that they were going to put in circulation. And, of course, the Federal Reserve was considered the banker's bank. Before the Federal Reserve, banks issued notes. You know, and I've told many stories about banks issuing notes. And what the note said was that if you bring this note to this bank, they will give you 10 silver dollars. Or if it's, you know, a $20 bill, they'll give you an ounce of gold. Or 20 silver ounces. And of course, one of the problems was is that we began to denominate money, where you would say that, you know, 20 ounces of silver is worth an ounce of gold. When all we should have said is, this is an ounce of gold, and this is an ounce of silver. And let the market decide. You know, if there's a lot of gold around, the value, and not much silver, the value of the silver may go up in relationship to the gold, or vice versa. It may go up the other way. If you live in a town where there's a silver mine, silver will, you know, increase in value. If you live in a town where there's a gold mine but no silver mine, silver will increase in value because it's not as available. So, if I said that right, but anyway, you get the gist of it, is that that's just weights and measures. It's not denominations. We begin to denominate the coin. Now, that's just an example. So now you can take words. I just heard Michael Knowles and Wes is going for his doctorate. Very outspoken guy. I can't think of his whole name right now. But Wes and Michael Knowles in an interview about the Bible. He's quite the scholar, Wes is. And he was, Michael Knowles, who's, he referred to himself in the interview as a raving papist. I think that was what he called himself. And of course, he's being funny. But as funny as Michael Knowles gets, I think the world of Michael Knowles, but he has become a Catholic. He wasn't for a long time, and he's become a Catholic or returned to Catholicism. But he was talking about Jerome, who was the, you know, rewrote in Latin the Greek scriptures. And even you mentioned Ptolemy, he translated from the Hebrew to Greek with 70 scholars, 70 so scholars. There was actually more, but 70 basically. And the reality is that Jesus quotes the Septuagint. And so, but is everything in the Septuagint correct? Well, unless you can read the Greek and the Hebrew, you can't really tell. And then there is the preconceived notions when you're reading the words. But Jerome said, bishops, presbyters, which is the word for elder, and deacons occupy in the church the same position as those which were occupied by Aaron, his sons, and the Levites in the temple. That's his Epistle 146. You can go look it up. People can look it up. So Jerome, who he advocates, says that the bishops and elders, which are the heads of families, we have an article on that, and deacons, which is the ministers of 10, bishops are the ministers of 10 deacons because it's the tens, hundreds, and thousands again. It's not like if I say bishops, everybody thinks of what we think of today as bishops. But if you go back to the time, what did they think when you said episcopo, which is what we translate into bishop? What did they think when you said presbyter, which is what we translate into elders? And what did they think when you said deacon, which is a minister of 10? Well, they knew that Christ said to sit down in these tens, hundreds, and thousands. And they knew this pattern from history. It was familiar with them still. I mean, in those days, the synagogue was 10 families. That's by definition, that's what it was. So when they sat down in groups of 10 families, there when Jesus and the loaves and fishes, every group of 10 was a synagogue by the language of the day. But now if I say synagogue, you think down there somewhere where there's rabbis and the Jews all meet and on Sabbath, and that's what you think a synagogue is. But a synagogue was 10 families. So there's been a slow redefining of words that you read the same word in the biblical text. Now, sometimes in some of the translations, they play with the translation, and we go through that all the time. But and show you. That's why I go back and not just show you the Strong's number a lot of times, but I show you the actual letters that are used in the word. Now, I don't want everybody to have to learn Hebrew or have to learn Greek, but I'm showing you with their own documentation. If I was being interviewed by Michael Knowles, I'd point out, well, wait a minute. You think the world of Jerome? Jerome said the church replaced Aaron and the Levites. And the Levites were the church in the wilderness. We see the word church in the wilderness in the modern Greek translation of the New Testament. But they're just saying the ecclesia in the wilderness. Because ecclesia is the Greek word for called out, and it's the word that we translate into church. Well, who was called out in the wilderness? It was, he called out everybody who would do things according to the ways of the Lord. And most of those who came out were Levites, and so they became the priests of that society. But then when I say priests, you think of the priest down there with a white collar at the church. But what was the priest doing? Well, he was at the altars of stone. He was actually one of the stones of the altar because they were living stones, like I point out in the book, Thy Kingdom Comes, and in the article, Sophistry at Preparing You. You can go read these things out. Maybe I'll remember to put these links into the words, the study that we'll have with this recording. But those altars, the same word for a gathering of stones is a gathering of men. So when they're talking about stone altars, they're talking about men gathered together. Go ahead, somebody.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And the biggest deception, I think, is that we take, I remember as a Christian, thinking about why would people bow down to a statue? It never made sense to me. How can anybody be so dumb to think a statue was going to do something for them? And that is the biggest deception. And the thing that, in listening to you over the last couple of months, woke me up was the understanding of what the golden calf was, taking right. all the gold, putting it in one place.
Yeah, you see.
And if they were,
you're right.
Yeah.
That's their Fort Knox. And of course, now we can't get an audit, but if you wanted an audit of your Fort Knox back in the day, the Greeks all had golden statues, not all, but all the ones who had big temples and walls around their cities, they had golden statues. And then, of course, there were silver statues in the local governors and stuff like that. And, of course, that's what Nimrod was doing. We've explained that in the last several studies over and over again in our study on Terah and all that stuff, who was an idolater, what they were actually doing. But I was actually going, you know, to do roofing in a nearby town, and my son was reading a book. It was about 2 inches thick. It was Punic Wars, Peloponnesian Wars. And he was reading, and I said, why don't you just read out loud, and maybe I'll learn something. And he started reading about the golden statue at the temple being a reserve fund, I'm going to forget his name now, the famous general, Perseus or whatever it was, who went in and sawed off part of the statue to melt it down, make coins, and buy ships for the war effort. And they were all upset because you were pilfering their treasury, which was what they put their faith in. And Jesus talks about treasuries, putting your faith in the treasury where thieves and robbers can break in and steal and not let you do an audit, which is where we're at today. Where you're supposed to be investing is in the kingdom. And in the kingdom, the gold and silver that is your just weights and measures is in the pockets of everybody who you sit down with in the tens, hundreds, and thousands. And if you have a need, they get the choice as to whether they want to help you or not. And they have to make a good choice, a wise choice, so that if they need help, there will be people there to help them. And eventually that help may come down. Can you imagine going across the Red Sea, the parting of the Red Sea, and I don't believe it was like you see Cecil B. DeMille's. We can talk about that. Well, I have already talked about it. You go read our chapters on that. But the reality is that you got every man, woman, and child in their nation, which is at least thousands of people, if not hundreds of thousands of people, crossing this little isthmus of land, 10 miles across that particular spot. And there's an army over there that's being held at bay by a column of fire, which also didn't look like what Cecil B. DeMille says it looked like. But it's a great movie. It's just not 100% accurate, but it's a story. But the reality is, some of those people could hardly walk. Some of those people had been walking, and they needed help, and that people needed to be carried, and you know, they had to work together to get across there. And the walking was probably pretty smooth because it was pretty sandy. It's pretty sandy right there. It wasn't real rocky until you start coming up the other edge. But the reality is that's what they were learning for their first weeks and years, is learning what it meant to help one another. We don't know how to do that. We're not very good at that. But we could at least start sitting down in the tens, hundreds, and thousands. And we could start taking care of one another and setting the example that Christ was setting up. Now, I'm not a big advocate of Jerome. I'll just throw that out there. But I did quote him on our page. If you want to go look up the Levites, we have a page at preparingyou.com, and it will tell you about Jerome. And under the one of the pictures down, the third picture down, I have that quote from his epistle, 146. That was commonly accepted in Christianity. But now, because of new doctrines that have crept in the last 50 to 150 years, suddenly, you know, and I don't know where it came from. Some people say the Jesuits. I actually have got two stories about who started Muhammad. Somebody had to finance Muhammad to begin with and start the Muslim religion. And I have heard from some scholars that say that it was the Catholics who funded the Muslim religion to fight against the Jews. And then I heard from another group of scholars who happen to be Jews who said it was the Pope who funded Muhammad to start a religion to counteract the Christians. So, and there may be some truth in both of those stories, and there's probably some lies in both of those stories. And people can debate them until the UFOs land, whatever that is. But the reality is, I can tell the difference between loving your neighbor and coveting your neighbor's goods. When I was taking care of people, and my wife is still doing it, we have another neighbor who's bedridden now. And the wife is struggling to take care of him, but she can't do it alone. We have another older couple that we're doing. We're not a lot of people out here, but we're learning by doing. And the fact is that we could start showing people how to do this and on a bigger scale, but we need people sitting down in the tens, hundreds, and thousands and wanting to see it done the way the early church was doing it. That's what's going to make America great. It's not going to make the United States great, but it's going to make Americans great. And hopefully they'll help Canadians who want to become great and Australians and Englishmen and Frenchmen even. So, but anyway, like we're getting close to 2 hours here. There's still several more notes that I could go over. You know, I have the question, what is Mystery Babylon? Mystery Babylon is, it's Babylon that people can't see. They can't see that they're actually in Babylon. They can't see that they already have the mark of the beast. They can't see that they cannot get into the marketplace without the number. And we have articles that show this, that the Social Security number in the United States, the national insurance number in another country, the social insurance number in another country, which spells sin. All these are numbers given by governments all over the world. You can go down to Nicaragua and they'll have a little card, or go out to an island in the Caribbean and go to Santo Domingo, and they have a Sechula card. It's got a number on it. All those cards, all those numbers are connected by treaties between these countries so that people don't double dip, although some countries allow them to double dip, but because people have dual citizenship, but that's another whole story. But the point is they're all connected. And yeah, they're still consolidating World Economic Forum and putting everybody in computers. And yeah, they're probably developing a chip, but you already got the number. You already are coveting your neighbor's goods, desiring benefits that are provided at the expense of your neighbor. And not by the money he's going to pay in today or tomorrow, but by money you're borrowing against the future of your children, which is why Peter says you'll become merchandise, because you bite the bait. You'll become merchandise, and the bait is that it's okay to covet your neighbor's goods through the men who exercise authority. That's what makes you merchandise, the covetous practices of these numbered systems. And we show you that the Corban of the Pharisees was an identical system set up by Herod and the Pharisees through the civil law. They had two different kinds of tax collector, Gabbai and Malkai. But you got a number. You got a Hebrew name. But that Hebrew name translated into a number. And because every letter in Hebrew is a number. And so everybody got a unique identifying number or name. They carved it on a stone, or they put it in a clay, little clay tessera, and that showed that you were a member. And Herod was trying to get hundreds of thousands of members. But Jesus comes along, John the Baptist comes along, and they don't number the people. David didn't number the people. He started to, but he repented of it. Because by numbering them, it's a part of that creeping in process where they're going to take away your choice because they got you numbered. You have to, in order to be a free people, you have to create free assemblies, and you have to do it on a small basis and then link them all together in a network of charity and love, because it's the charity and love, same word in the Greek, that will bind you together with the bonds that will make a difference. But even if you did all that, without the spiritual arm of God Almighty coming in, and he will come in if you open the door to him, open the door to his light, start doing what he says, he will take up the slack that we will never be able to get to. He will provide the increase. But we at least have to repent, think differently. We're showing you a different way to think about this. Turn around and start going the other way, towards the Corban of Christ instead of the Corban of the Pharisees.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that I think the biggest deception of all is all of the fables and the fairy tales that we want to believe, rather than realizing that the Bible tells you exactly what it means when it's talking about the first beast, that it is a government system, a world system. And then the second beast, everybody wants to say, oh, it's the Catholic Church, or it's this, or the first one they want to say is the church, and the one church, different kind of church. They don't realize it's governments. And then the second beast they want to say is a person. And it's like, no, it's Satan himself coming as Christ. And a lot of people don't believe that, but it pretty much, it lays it out that first you have a system, and then you have a savior, one being. And all of the fables with bowing down to idols and things like that, and child sacrifice, and it's like there needs to be a book saying this is what it really means, just one single definition of each thing, that yes, you know, like you say, they may have done that there, you know, but the message is this: there's going to be a system, and it's already here. It's been here,
right? But one of the things we need to guard against is trying to figure out, you know, identify all the weeds. Is the personage that is the servant of the devil himself, the occupied soul, is he here already? Well, I think he might be. I think I might even know who he is. But it doesn't make any difference if I told you. If I identified exactly which beast is which beast. And you know, you talk about, you know, the first time I heard of the Catholic Church being the harlot riding the beast is in a Bible that's on my shelf right over there. I can't see it because the screen's in the way. But it's the Confraternity Bible I had in the seminary studying in the Catholic Church. And I read the footnote when it referred to the city of Seven Hills being Rome. And it's telling you in the Confraternity Bible, identifying you, that the seven, you know, these are seven hills. Wow. Now, I'm not saying that they're accurate, but they were telling you. But then it also talks in the same book about the daughters of the harlot. Who is that? Well, that's all the rest of the Christians. It doesn't matter. And if we're doing finger pointing at these other guys, who's the harlot, who's the daughters of the harlot, who's the beast, who's the actual guy who's going to be there, we will neglect what we need to do. All that information is knowledge and information, but it doesn't help you know God. To right. know God, you have to lay down your life like Christ. You have to come together like Christ, who came to sacrifice himself. And then the Holy Spirit will give you power without knowledge. You won't even need the knowledge. The knowledge won't make any difference. It will be the Holy Spirit that makes the difference.
Right, because the whore is anyone who is not following the one way.
Right.
Well, and the Antichrist has been here even when Christ was here. He said anything that is not of Christ is the instead of Christ.
So what is the difference?
So we get so wrapped up.
What's the difference between what's the difference between a whore and the wife who is more precious than a ruby in Proverbs? Because Proverbs talks about women and whores, or they have another word in the text there that for some reason I can't remember what it is, but it means basically the whore. In Proverbs mentions this more than any other. Wisdom is mentioned more than any other book. But the reality is the whore is doing it for profit. It's providing care. It's providing caresses. It's tickling your ears. It's whatever it's doing. It's doing it for its own personal gain. But the true church is not looking for gain from you. Hey, it's looking for gain from the Holy Spirit. It's coming in the spirit of the Creator, who said the God. In order for you to have the right to make any kind of choice whatsoever, it has to, God has to let you have that choice. It has to give you the right to make that choice, to so that you're not just a puppet. In order to do that, he has to withhold his power. Because if he spread his power everywhere, if there was no shadows, no darkness, and God's power was just everywhere, you couldn't make anything but the right choices, but you wouldn't be making a choice. He has to give you that opportunity of choice. So there has to be darkness, and there has to be light. And you have to go to the light to make the right choice. And the light is not the tree of knowledge. The light is the tree of life. It's a different place that we have to go to find our salvation. So how do you find the tree of life? You're willing to see the truth about your errors. Error of Balaam, error of the Nicolaitan, error of selfishness, error of pride, all these things that we call vices, which are just the absence of virtue. And then we have to be willing to make the expenditure of the life that God has given us already to be of service to that light, to do what that light wants us to do. And it may be different for you than it is for me, but in principle, we should see the basic same things taking place. Caring for others.
And see the contrast.
Yeah.
The contrast of what the world is doing as opposed to the few.
And so if we're looking to our knowledge, we're over there with the tree of knowledge. You know, this is what people are always getting in Revelation. They say, well, what does this mean in Revelation? What does that mean? They're trying to get knowledge so that they have an edge. If you want an edge, stop eating of the tree of knowledge. Now, that's what I have one of these ridiculous tasks, and I say this all the time. I'm giving people all kinds of knowledge about what it actually says in the Bible. And Mark was making reference to it. We have lots of articles to show the individual words. You know, if the Levite was one of the stones of the altar, and you can't chisel the stone of the altar, in other words, you can't regulate them, he has to fit together without being chiseled by men who exercise authority. So he has to be separate from the state. And he is given the kidneys as his share of the sacrifice. And then I point out the same exact word for kidney in Hebrew is also the word for reins of control. You're not giving the Levite the kidneys of dead sheep. You're giving him exactly. The reins of control of your sacrifice. If it's just ashes, then what has he got control of? Nothing. No, he's got a sheep there that he can butcher and share the meat with the poor. Even the Quran, written 400, 600 AD, the Quran tells you that when they have a sacrifice, that you, of course, they do it a little bit different in the Quran, but you have to cut up the meat that's going to go to the poor, and you have to deliver it to the poor before you can eat any of the meat. When they have their Ramadan and all this stuff, and they're going to eat after the sun sets and everything, they have to deliver the portion of that sacrifice that's going to go to the poor, before they eat a single bite. It's still symbolic. Of course, they get lost in the rituals, and they may follow that particular pattern. But if you go to England right now, what is it, like 70% of the Muslim immigrants are on welfare with the state. But they don't equate the sacrifice. They're eating the sacrifices with blood in it, because the sacrifices they're eating still has the blood, not only of the people who live in England, but the children born in England will be paying off their debt, because they have the same debt problem we do. The debt is so big in all these countries that every single thing you receive, even Thomas Sowell, if you go to our page on Thomas Sowell, I quote him. Go to our page on Social Security, I quote Thomas Sowell on there. He says you can't take one single benefit from the government, even though you paid in, like Mark was saying. though you paid it, you cannot take one single benefit without men who are going to force other people to pay in because you're getting those benefits because they're borrowing money. They're borrowing in debt to provide you with the benefits today. They're borrowing against tomorrow to provide you with the benefits today. And that is the cities of blood. And it's the blood of your children. Every time you take one of those benefits, you are sacrificing your children and your children's children to the debt that you're creating. It's just a matter of arithmetic. You know?
Yeah.
But you have to be willing to see it. Go ahead.
There's no common sense.
Yeah. Well, it's just there is common sense. It's just not as common as it needs to be. But anyway, nice hearing from everybody. We've gone our 2 hours, and I've tried to keep these down. If we want to repeat this, you know, the bait and the bondage next week, part two, we can. And I appreciate the questions. But next time, everybody come with lots of questions, and we'll see if we can answer them. But thank you, everybody, for coming. And I pray that you are all well. Until next time, God bless.
Thank you.
For more information, go to hisholychurch.org or preparingyou.com. Join the network. Listen to the audios at most podcast providers under Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory. Thanks, everyone, and God bless. Make sure you follow us at His Holy Church on X.